Your favorite imports you've never played and why they didn't come to the West in the first place. The differences between translation and localization, and why the Famicom isn't merely the Japanese version of the NES. I'm the Well-Read Mage, and this is MageCast X. Our first episode ever that's entirely centered around a single console may have come about by accident, but there are few systems more deserving of exploration than the Famicom. Joining us this time is Joe Borey, game developer and author of the upcoming book Beyond the NES, Rediscovering 8-Bit on the Japanese Famicom. Our initial goal when we invited him on was to discuss one of the more well-known games on the Famicom, Doki Doki Panic, and its placement in Super Mario and localization history. But we bit off a bit more than we could chew, and wound up with a meaty first discourse centered around the Famicom itself. If you've always wanted to learn more about the system and its elusive games, stick around for the guided tour through video game history. You'll find that Joe Borey is a living museum. In a gaming world full of shouting, mudslinging, gaslighting, and screaming into the void, MageCast X is the podcast for conversationalists. Learn more at thepixels.com, that's the-pixels.com. You can support the show by visiting patreon.com/thepixels. We greatly appreciate every listen, every rating, every review, and every comment. And now, let's summon the show. Hello, my friends. Welcome back to MageCast X. That's right, the world's favorite isekai. This is the Well-Read Mage, a.k.a. Moses Norton. How are you? Thanks for joining us. I'm joined today by, as ever, our co-host, Jared, a.k.a. Criterion X. How are you, dude?
I'm doing good. I'm about to say, how are you holding up today?
I'm good. I slept on my neck wrong, so they had to rush me to the hospital. I'm kidding. There's like a meme, right? It was like, 30-year-old man rushed to the hospital for sleeping wrong. It's like, yeah, that's life right now, isn't it? But how are you doing?
Okay, I'm doing all right. Also, just been going through the motions, both I think physically and mentally, but feeling good today, feeling good about doing this recording. I'm actually particularly excited about this episode because we're going to be getting into some themes that I've been interested in probably for a very, very long time. And I just realized I don't get the chance to talk about it. So this is where, again, I get to take advantage of the opportunities to actually get into the things that I'm passionate about. So.
There variety.
I know. Like good variety.
Yeah. We're like a variety show, except nobody dances.
So. No, because or sings, which is what you want me to do. That's what you still want me to do.
Yeah. You've got to get on the singing bandwagon. I've been doing the singing. There might be some singing this episode. Just do that. All right. And then our guest today is someone who recently made a very exciting announcement, but I'll let him talk about that. We are here joined by Cinco Play, a.k.a. Joe Borey. How are you, sir?
Hey, doing great. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic. Ready to talk about a lot of exciting retro stuff. Now, I use the word exciting maybe like 5 times so far this episode.
I mean, it is exciting.
It is.
At least I'm excited about it.
No, it's great. It's fun to get excited for games that are like, you know, almost as old as I am. You know,
or in some cases older.
In some cases older. I will not reveal which is which as far as this game today. But Joe, you recently put out a fantastic announcement. Would you care to tell us a little bit about yourself? And then do tell us about the announcement, would you, sir?
Yeah, absolutely. I am one of lifelong gamer, been playing video games since the mid 80s. You know, obviously grew up with my NES, grew up with the game we're going to be talking about today. But I, you know, went into video game design and development as a career path. And it's been fun. It's been a good time. Worked on a number of pretty big properties, but always sort of yearned for the game's past, the stuff that that got me excited about this industry to begin with. And so in the last decade or so, been running Single Play Retro Gaming, which is kind of my company focused all around different aspects of retro games. And my latest announcement, as Moses has brought up, is a book, Beyond the NES, which is a breakdown of how to enjoy and appreciate the Nintendo Famicom as an English speaker who doesn't understand Japanese.
Nice. And keywords from that book, no Japanese required. So there is a sample actually available for this book. There's going to be a link in the description, folks. So you're going to want to check that out. Beyond the NES. Don't say NES. If that's you, stop. Okay. Beyond the NES.com. Go there and check out. It's a 32 page sample. Is that right?
Yeah. 32 page, including a really cool piece of cover art made by my friend Dustin Hansen. And yeah, it's a Where's Waldo of Famicom references.
Nice.
The book itself is totally inspired by, reading through old gaming magazines from the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. including as often as possible archival quality, scans and, recreations of the old pages. So no, it's a fun time.
Awesome. Well, I do want to dig more into that book. But before we do that, let's backtrack a little bit and talk about some of your history. So it's Syncoplay, and mm-hmm. you actually mentioned this recently. You got that from Syncopated?
Yeah, so there was a point in which Syncoplay was more my goal of doing indie video game development, and I did a game a while back and needed a company name. So incorporated under Syncoplay because the way I looked at it is my goal was to make kind of offbeat games, and mm-hmm. syncopation, a musical term for playing off the beat. And I thought it was a fun play on words. So
yes.
Then once I owned the company, switch over to retro gaming, kept the name. I thought it was cool.
Perfect. And you know what? The coincidence is it's a ragtime turn as far as I know it. Just played some ragtime on the piano. That's where I learned syncopated. But there's ragtime in Mario 2. And here you are, Syncoplay, doing it. Yeah, so it all makes sense. Now you
completely intentional.
Completely intentional. That was why we chose this topic. So you've been a game designer. You've worked on a Tetris game.
Mm-hmm. Tetris Blitz for mobile, iOS, and Android.
That's pretty cool. Okay. That's pretty cool. Did you have the chance to meet like Hank Rogers or?
Yeah.
Alexei Pajitnov, right?
So what's funny is that you know, Hank, I worked with Hank a number of times during the process of making Tetris Blitz. Alexei Pajitnov, I met in very different circumstances. I was showing off a previous game at EA at a press event, and Alexei was there as well. And he came up and started asking me questions about the game that I was working on. I'm sorry. First, he went and started asking one of my friends that I worked with questions, and he didn't know how to answer them. And he just kind of thought that this was just some random dude that stumbled in off the street.
Oh,
and so he's like, I can't even understand through the, like my friend couldn't understand through his accent or anything. And finally, he was just like, hey, Joe, can you answer this guy's question? And like dumped him off on me.
Oh, this guy who maybe had like invented the world's most famous video game.
No, wait a minute.
So I start talking to him, and the things that he's asking about my game are like, they are a little bonkers. But you could tell that he was passionately like digging in and trying to understand why you would do this versus this in my game. And finally, I'm just kind of like, hey, my name's Joe. I didn't catch your name. He's like, Alexei, Tetris is my game.
Oh,
and I would have lost it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, in moments like that, it is hard to stay stone faced where it's just like, oh, cool. That's really awesome. Right. But you don't want to fanboy out in the middle of a press event.
Absolutely. Yeah. So did you not recognize him at all?
Oh, no. I mean, it's when you're at an event like that.
Yeah.
It's,
there's
it's
a lot
crazy,
going on.
Right. There's so much going on.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And I had no idea that there was even a Tetris game at the event, let alone think that Alexei Pajitnov might be there showing it. So
wow. That's pretty
incredible though.
Once I took Cuba Gooding Jr.'s order at a register.
Love it.
That's the closest. Okay, so you've also worked for EA THQ. Have you ever caught flack for working at EA? Because there's people there is just like, you know.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely. No,
yeah.
it's okay. it, It happens. The thing about it is that there's a lot of really cool, really talented people working at Electronic Arts. I mean, they have got some incredible developers and mm-hmm. the production staff and the design staff and everybody are really good at what they do. And I mean, we can't control the decisions of upper management. I'll leave it at that.
That totally makes sense.
I mean, EA has a very complex history. Like, if you look at it, even beyond the point in which obviously a lot of judgment is made for the decisions that were made. But if you, you know, talk about EA back in like the 90s or even like the late 80s, you're talking about an entirely different company, I feel like.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. They made some good Lord of the Rings games.
That vindicates everything right there.
My favorite IP. Thanks for that, EA. Well, awesome. So, like I said, folks, definitely check out the book. It is self-described here as English-friendly Famicom games. So, I don't think I have any kind of complex relationship with imports in general. I think I own three or four of them, and like almost all of them were gifted to me. I haven't really run out of like English games to play yet, so I haven't really explored a lot of Japanese imports. But I do know that a lot of people are interested in Japanese imports, and so I hope that you consider this book as a good reference point for the Famicom system, and check out the reviews and walkthroughs and the information, the magazine scans and things like that that are inside of it.
I want to jump in real quick. I actually have some of the scans from the book available, and I have to, I know, Joe, you highlighted the fact that you wanted to go for a certain aesthetic, a style that takes you back to the classic, like sort of what's a Nintendo Power, just video game magazine in the past, and you've done an incredibly successful job of that. I'm looking at some of these scans right now, and I'm just kind of drooling looking at it. Like, this is just exactly the kind of things I've been looking for in terms of video game history for so long. So I just want to stress to the people listening, please, 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 please put in, what's it? Was it 32 pages for free?
Yes. Yeah.
Please, please do so if it's a free download. It looks absolutely amazing. Yeah.
All you have to do is plug in your social security number. It's
no, don't you even. No, no, no.
No, your email. Your email. Your email.
No, no, the worst like part. No, you're not going to know the worst.
I'm only
part
collecting emails.
Oh, no.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. The color choice, the layout style.
The borders, like even just the borders.
It's very
pages,
nostalgic.
Very, very nice. Yeah.
So I was the kid who, when my parents are grocery shopping, I'm in the magazine aisle pouring through GamePro and EGM and Nintendo Power. When I would stumble on some money for Christmas, I would spend it on a subscription so I could have those magazines all year round, and have this massive stack of old gaming magazines. I'd sit there and sort of, I couldn't afford to buy the game, so I'd live vicariously through the magazines, pretending I'm playing the games through the maps and all of that. And like, there's all these games that I got introduced to through these classic gaming magazines. Mm-hmm. And the huge goal with this book is there's a wealth of games that came out for the Famicom that we were never introduced to by those magazines. So in a way, my book is filling in that gap and giving us that introduction that we could have had in 1990, but didn't. So
awesome. Awesome. Yeah, I remember looking at the magazine layouts, especially for platformers, when they would, you know, create that huge long row of the screens from the game all stacked side by side, and just moving my finger from like platform to platform. You jump here, you backtrack it. Oh, but there's a power up here, and you got to get that. It was such a unique time to be alive.
What was it? I'm just, you know what just gets my, what I like about this topic is that we're talking about the idea of an entire generation of games that were available to one part of the world but wasn't available to the other. And I think, not to dox myself too much, but in particular living in New York, it's a very interesting history in terms of like localization, because there are shops in New York City that had Japanese imports specifically, but they weren't like, these were very, I don't want to say black market, but these were sort of stores that weren't always listed. So you would go into like these sort of the electronic stores that would just have these Japanese copies. And the big thing during my generation was Pokemon games, like the early generations of it. So when a Pokemon game would get released in Japan, I think first time I was thinking about it was like, I think Pokemon Silver and Pokemon Gold. I remember a friend of mine went to some store in Flushing, Queens, and was able to get like a Japanese copy of Pokemon Silver before it was released in the US, and was playing it on the playground, not knowing, you know, how to read anything, because it was obviously in Japanese. But I just, again, now that we're actually getting to this topic, I'm like having these like little recollections of my memory where it's like, wait, the whole idea of like Japanese games, like never coming, either coming to the West later or never coming, like there's a whole history of that within my own region. So I'm very happy we're talking about this.
Probably facilitated by you being on the coast too.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, like, by comparison. Oh, sorry.
No, I'll go ahead, sir.
I was just going to say, by comparison, I grew up out in the middle of nowhere in Eastern Oregon, and we were lucky to have, you know, 4 or 5 new games available at the local shops that were American games. And so, like, to me, if it wasn't for the rental shops, the vast majority of video games would have been off limits for most of my childhood.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's sort of an experience that I had even with our games now. And now, like, I think most of us have it with the import games of these mysterious other games.
Yeah. And it's sort of like there's something like a romantic notion about it, about getting your hands on something that you're not sure whether you even should have your hands on. Cause again, geographic location was everything in terms of video game releases.
I love that phrasing, romantic.
It is romantic. I mean, because it's like there's a mystery. You don't have all the info. You don't have the internet to explain all this information to you, but you go with what you have. And there was, I don't know, a very, I think, romantic time in video game history where, you know, the same as like trying to discover myths behind games, like video game secrets, where it's like, what is it behind this game that I can't even read the text to, or I don't understand the visuals 100%. There's like, I felt like there was an entire culture of that during a certain period. At least it was for me when I was very, very young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think, too, it's acknowledging that the world's smaller now than it was 30 years ago. You know, seems like it's much easier for games to be brought to a worldwide stage now, depending on the game, obviously. You know, and a lot of companies are bringing older Japanese exclusives that had been exclusive for decades. Yes. Now are getting HD remakes or 2D HD,
well,
whatever.
They'll just
they're
throw it on the Switch
now.
Online and not even think twice about it. And it's like, no, wait a minute, this was something that was never released, and they'll just throw it casually from their own vault.
Yeah, you look at Switch Online, you're like, what are these choices? But then at the same time, like, some of those have never seen the light of day over here too, which is exciting in its own way. And again, I like that you said romanticize. I think, to an extent, and Joe, you'll have to forgive me too. This is not a reference to Joe at all. But I think that there's a fetishizing of Japanese culture as well, that tends to make imports that much more like glamorous, you know. But the grounded reality of that, though, to kind of, and here's the nuanced statement, the grounded reality of that, though, is that these are real games that are like actually fun to play, that are not just like these kind of, like, they're more than just little time capsules of, you know, an anime that you
And I'm happy you're mentioning that, because that's the problem. You get lost in almost the romantic aesthetic of the idea of like, god, like, it's this mystery game that has finally come out, and it's like, okay, but how is the game actually like, what are the like
Live Alive, like, freaking Live Alive, like it comes it out just, and I'm like, oh, this game should have stayed in Japan. Like, I'm sorry. That's my take.
I mean, from a preservationist, again, I have like a historian background. Yes. Like, you have to explain the most basic components of it before we can get into the entire, you know, even with something like Mother 3, like, I've played the Mother 3 franchisation, and I know we have a question involving it, but it's like, it's almost become a joke at this point of the idea of Mother 3 getting a release. Yeah. And it's like, no, but if you want this to be a thing, you also have to explain what is the significance of Mother 3. What does it bring to the table, like, on pen and paper? And it's something that, I don't know. Just gets
see, that's
going.
The kind of stuff you can only say on a podcast.
I know.
Right there.
If I tweet that, I'm just going to get a question mark.
Oh, if you tweet, you would get destroyed if you tweeted that. Yeah. And even to writing it out in a blog, you can't really like explain yourself as well as if you were using like your real voice. So I think that was pretty nuanced. If somebody came out of that little discussion there like, well, I'm offended, I'm sorry. But it's a, I think it's a, it's, It's a wide range of discussion that could have happened right there. But it's to acknowledge that these are real games with their own real merits that just happened to not come over to the West.
Yes, even Live Alive.
Even Live Alive. I was, I would joke that I can see why even the Japanese didn't want Live Alive when it first came out. It's super prototypical. I'm like, so when does this do anything? But anyways, someday we'll have to do a Live Alive
episode. Oh, I can't wait for that one. Great.
We have to get on somebody who loves the game, though, because that makes it really interesting, you know, when there's like difference of opinion. And we'll just call each other names and mudsling. I'm just going to sit there. Well, this is episode 95 of MageCast X. Title is, did you know that Mario 2 is? And we're talking about Yume Kojo Doki Doki Panic, which was developed by Nintendo and published by Nintendo and Fuji Television Network in 1987 for the Family Computer Disk System. Starstruck Game 1 said, I know this because I played Doki Doki Panic on the Disk System first, and I got a shock later on when they introduced Super Mario Bros. 2. To be honest, I was a bit miffed at Nintendo. Points to you for using the term miffed, by the way. I don't see that too often. I was a bit miffed at Nintendo for doing that because I thought the four main characters didn't deserve to disappear like that. Joe, do you know the names of the four main characters? Oh. I wasn't going to ask you this, but it just dawned on me. Like, I don't know.
I'm not off the top of my head now.
Yeah. I think it's like Prince, Princess, Onion Dude, and Piccolo. I think that's what
Let's go with that. I like that.
Yeah. and I'll leave you to sort out which character is which.
That's okay. We'll let someone else handle that. We'll get the comment.
We'll let
later.
That hang in the air. Yeah, that's for fan theorists to deal with. and then here's a tweet from 1PVCPU. Did you know in Japan, Sonic originally released as Doki Doki Sanic? I was cracking up about that one last night. Doki Doki Sanic, originally ported by Hudson Soft. The screen could not scroll diagonally, hence why there's artifacting on the edge of your bum. Now, is this true or not? Because Doki Doki Sanic is a little meme-y.
Well, you know, as far as the artifacting on the edge of my bum goes, I was wondering where that birthmark came from. So,
okay, I'm going to Google Doki Doki Sanic.
If I start calling it Sanic, I'm going to be very mad. I'm just letting you know. I'm looking at it right now, the way that it's spelled, and I'm like, if this accidentally goes in my vernacular, then I'm just, there goes my entire love of the series right there.
Just
is that an onomatopoeia? Doki Doki?
It's like heart pounding, right?
Okay, got it. So like Doki Doki Literature Club, right, is the other game.
Like if we call it Doki Doki Sanic now for the rest of the stream, then maybe it can become a meme, you know? It's my
there you go.
It. There you go.
Yeah. That's how you get famous right there, is memes. but speaking of memes, we do want to go beyond the meme on this episode. So like one thing that was important for us when choosing the topic that would let us talk to Joe, 2, let us talk about his book, and 3, be related to the Famicom, was what game would kind of like, you know, casual listeners have as like a frame of reference or like be able to, you know, recognize. And the immediate game that comes to your mind is Doki Doki Panic because of the meme, of course. But it's also important to acknowledge that Joe's book is more than about just, did you know that Mario 2 is Doki Doki Panic? So if that was at all on your radar of concerns, you can lay that one to rest. It's one of those irritating, like, did you like calling Samus Metroid or Link Zelda? It's one of those things that like never goes away, you know? Have you found yourself kind of dogged by those memes as you discuss Famicom?
So sometimes, for sure. But the bigger one, for me, like, you know, the Doki Doki Panic thing, it's funny, right? Because everybody has had their moment where they have said that thinking that the audience wasn't aware. And at this point, we're all aware.
Yeah.
There are definitely a lot of other, I would say, more insidious memes in the Famicom community, often revolving around kusoge, which is kind of the Japanese term for crappy games, bad games. And those memes sometimes get in the way of actually talking intelligently about games that, if they had been released in the West, we just call them a flawed but interesting game. But because they get folded into the kusoge meme, they can become difficult to talk about. So that, I think, is the one I get dogged by more than the Doki Doki Panic one. But yeah, Doki Doki Panic, definitely, like to set some context for the listeners, when Red first talked to me about doing Doki Doki Panic, I'm just like, the last thing I want to do is be the Doki Doki Panic guy, especially since I might not even mention that game in this book. It's Famicom Disk System. Yeah. I haven't determined whether or not that actually goes into the book yet. But the goal is to help people find new stuff that they haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. And Doki Doki Panic is a fascinating part of gaming history. But yeah, we've kind of all seen it.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I was going to ask, how do you arrive at deciding what games go in and what games don't? But you said it right there.
Well sort of, yeah. There's a few other criteria there, but effectively the short version is it needs to be a game that didn't come out in the West, or if it did come out in the West, it came out in a fairly different form, and okay. that it matches. I did some surveys early on in developing this book asking, you know, what keeps you from playing Famicom? And the responses were, one, they didn't know what games were worth playing. You'd fire up an old adventure game and it'd be a bunch of Japanese text and you wouldn't have any fun. You'd turn it off and say, oh, I don't know what to play. And number two, it needs to be, they need to be able to get past the language barrier. It needs to be English friendly. Yeah. So that's sort of my criteria mm-hmm. for determining what goes in there is, okay. if you're an English speaker, can you play it? And does it do something interesting? And is it Famicom only?
No, and that's great that you've got a specific kind of goal in mind for this book. I think one thing that you see in the book scene for games is the encyclopedic mm-hmm. book, which I'm not a huge fan of. I've been able to leaf through some of those, but like I leafed through one and they gave like a paragraph to Chrono Trigger. I was like, what's the point of this book? You know, especially if that paragraph is just kind of like back of the box type stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, trying to squeeze the entire Super Nintendo mm-hmm. And Super Famicom library into one book is a lot. I had initially assumed that you were creating kind of a comprehensive Famicom encyclopedia, if you will. I think it's refreshing to know that you have more specific focuses than that.
Yeah, I have a whole stack of Famicom kind of compendiums you're talking about. Some that are like the entire 1,051 games that were released retail, some that include bootlegs, and some from a Western perspective, some from an Eastern perspective. I'm kind of like gathered various books, and I mean, some of them are very good at being a complete compendium of every Famicom game ever made. Some of them were clearly somebody who opened a game up in an emulator, played it for 5 minutes, and wrote what they thought it was about. But some of them are really good. But those already exist, for one, so yeah. why make it again? Yeah. And two, I don't think anybody out there cares what I think about a Mahjong game, right? Like mm-hmm. that's not what you're looking yeah. for. You're looking for stuff that you want to sit down and try and play yourself. I want you to go through this book and be excited about these games. So instead of expending energy and pages and resources and time writing about, you know, 15 different Mahjong games and over 50 baseball games, You know, I'm going to pick the ones that actually do something interesting and spend more time diving deep into those games to let, you know, people really kind of both get some enjoyment out of the books and find the games that they will enjoy to play.
No, like how, like you talk about pretty much like I would describe it as finding a spark. You're looking for the spark in the person who's going to be reading it to feel that same passion you clearly have for the entire history of this console, because it is an incredibly complex history. But the thing that I always struggle with in terms of anything that I'm passionate about is like, how do you generate that first spark for someone who's getting into it for the first time? And is there any particular methodology that you go for? Let's say if you pick one specific game that you want to include in this book, like what are like one or two very, very specific factors that you want to be included within that description that you think is going to generate that interest?
Yeah. So I've been doing that for myself for years now, right? This all started from my own kind of introduction and diving deep into the Famicom. Mm-hmm. I currently have a physical Famicom games collection of about 980 or so cartridges out of the 1,051 that were ever released. I have played nearly all of those cartridges. And I actually, just to show how much of a nerd I am, part of my kind of, I've got a tracking app to track all of the games that I have, and I have tagged them with things like no Japanese required, translation patch needed, et cetera, so that I can later go back and use that information, like for myself, but mm-hmm. also using it inside this book. But like for your question of sort of like, what are the very specific things that I'm looking for? It depends on how much space in the book I'm planning to give the game. And so okay. A great example of that is in the sample book, Higemaru Makaijima, which is, a Capcom, I like to call it Pirate Zelda. So I chose that to be the game that I did a 10-page full spoiler-controlled walkthrough within the okay. book, using original scans from the box, from the manual. Really, I mean, it probably took the most time of anything in the book to really get it right. But I chose that one because when I sat down to play it for the first time, I had a bad experience. And that experience was, I fire up the game, I start sailing the ship around in the ocean. I find a port. I go into the port and it gives me a line of Japanese text in the middle of the screen, dumps me back in the ocean. And I did that for like 20 minutes and got nowhere and got frustrated and looked online. And as soon as I looked online and learned the first place I needed to go, it taught me the flow of the game. And it's now one of my favorite early Famicom exclusives. It's an excellent adventure game. So
what's
then
the
I go
title
on
of the game. I'm sorry, piqued my own curiosity.
Higemaru Makaijima.
Okay.
There's a subtitle to it, but I'm not going to embarrass myself attempting to pronounce it here. but I go on YouTube after the fact and find that that's the same experience everybody else had, except most people didn't go and look it up afterwards. And so it just got tagged as, oh, this is a confusing, bad game. I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense. Then I buy a boxed copy of the game, open up the manual, and realize that the information that you need to get started was printed in the manual.
Oh,
so that was when I'm just like, this is the game I need to put in this book for the first time to show that the way that my walkthroughs are structured aren't structured like a here's all your spoilers and everything you need to do. They're structured to feed you information at the same speed that the original game in Japanese did. So the first section tells you what the manual told you. And then it's blocked into sections like, after you finish this island, read this. After you finish this island, read this. And it feeds you information at the rate the game would have, could you understand the language. So, like, that's sort of what I'm looking for as I play these games, are moments in which somebody might fire it up, not know what to do, and misunderstand the quality of the game because of it. Those are the ones I really want to feature.
Big Quest 64 vibes.
Oh, that was
I just have to stress, that was an incredible answer, by the way. I was fixed on that. So I got to just applaud you for that. I just feel like I had an entire little documentary that just happened. So.
Now, me and Quest Guy have become pretty good friends over our mutual love of shouting the things that we love at anybody who will listen.
It's more the method in which of how to do it.
Yeah, I believe the term that you used for yourself, Joe, was Chad Weeb, right? In our DMs. But big Quest 64 vibes in that how much that extra I want to say extra ludological material is, well, like outside of the game itself. Mm. I had to read the manual in order to kind of get Quest 64. And I'm less forgiving towards that because it's an N64 game. There's tons of dialogue. There's tons of characters that mm-hmm. could have communicated that manual material to me. Mm-hmm. It makes a little more sense that a Famicom game, because it's, you know, a little further removed back in time, does not necessarily have the space inside of it to explain rather what it sounds like complex. Okay. Systems yeah. in order to enjoy
this was 1986. This was 1 year yeah. after we got The Legend of Zelda, right? So we
which is a great example mm-hmm. of like a game that like you can play with all the information in the game itself, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like it presents its own kind of tutorials.
Well, sort of.
And
the walls you're supposed to blow up, the bush you're supposed to burn. Nah, right. it's a similar.
there's some experimentation, but like mm-hmm. what I mean is like you can find your first dungeon.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like my kids can do that. Like,
that's true.
It's not like you walk in there and then it shows you some cryptic text and then it kicks you out. No. You know what I mean?
And I absolutely like consider that to be a design flaw of Higemaru Makaijima, but you get past that design right. flaw, it's an excellent game. So.
Right. And I think that's the phrasing that I like there is like you acknowledge that it's a design flaw, but if you get over that, there is a game to appreciate there.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, you mentioned emulation earlier. This is not the emulation bashing segment of the show, folks. Yeah. But here I go. Now, I think that picking like a file name off of a ROM list is a really poor way to enjoy a video game.
Agreed.
Because
yes.
you really don't have much stakes involved in that. You're sort of just picking something at random. And at least my experience and the experience of a lot of people that I've spoken with are you pick a random game off a list, you play it for 2 minutes, and odds are you're not going to understand it. And then it winds up just being, you know, some crap game that you don't like.
Yeah.
And then you move on to the next one, you do it over and over, and then eventually you're like, yeah, I've played all those.
Well, I mean, it's hard to...
Did you really?
Yeah, well, it's also hard to really, like, describe the importance of the physicality of just even holding the video game cartridge, looking at the cover of it.
The video game, the manual, it's like the guide, that's the entire, all that
I'm
stuff.
Sorry, like, there's the plethora yeah. of games that I'm now playing for the first time because I have to use emulation for most of them. And no matter how
right.
good that's the quality the of the game is, right. what you're describing is a very real thing that I'm experiencing, which is when it gets to a point when accessibility becomes unlimited for even titles that have never been released, and even if there isn't a localization of it or not, what exactly are you getting out of it when you're removing so many... Like, the things that made me fall in love with the art form are so far removed at this point. Mm. So it's like, mm-hmm. what am I now paying attention to that can, like I said before, generate that same spark? And I'm having that issue, even with games that are critically acclaimed right now. But, mm-hmm. you know, even with video game history, that can be an issue because of how you described it. You just put in, let's say you put in a cart. It has a list of 8 options of games that have never come out. What are you supposed to look for at that point? Like, where's the sense of judgment? I don't know. That's at least how it is for me.
Well, as a you know, as a physical collector, right? I spent $70 on a loose copy of Pizza Pop for the Famicom, which is it's a late Famicom platformer. It's fairly rare. It's gotten fairly expensive, but I bought it for the collection. I put it in my console and start playing it for a few minutes, and my first impression was, "Oof, this is pretty rough." And if that was an emulator, I'd very likely have just been kind of like, okay, I'll go find another platformer and turned it off. Mm, yep. But I'm like, I spent good money on this game. Let me see where it goes.
Exactly. Right there.
Yep. And I get to level 2 and I'm like, oh, this is pretty good. I get to level 3. I'm like, oh no, this is actually really good. And I realize as I beat the game that level 1 of Pizza Pop is by far the worst level in the game. And as it continues on, it just gets better and more creative and more interesting. And it's like, that's something, an experience I probably never would have had I just fired it up in an emulator.
It feels like Star Trek syndrome at that point. Like Star Trek Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, like, you know, they're not known for being high quality sci-fi entertainment in the first season. You have to wait until, you know, what, the third or fourth season, and then it becomes something miraculous. But that's the problem right now, is that people don't have the time and patience for really that anymore. If you can't, it's like, to have people have the patience to wait for something to develop, it's hard to do that when the accessibility is just so easy now. Because like you just said, you can just put it away. And if you pay, like if you paid money for this specific thing, you're not going to put it down, which means you're going to give it that time. That's just how it used to be back in the day. Like even with rentals and everything, like we've played plenty of games that, you know, we sunk hours into where at the end of it, it didn't really amount to what it said it was going to be. But the memories of those titles still stick more with me than a game that is critically acclaimed where I put it on for a minute because I was able to do so and then played for an hour and be like, wow, that was amazing. And then just it goes right out the door.
It's the difference between a microwaved corn dog and your mom's like Thanksgiving dinner.
Exactly.
You know, it really is like it's the ascribing of value. So like what Joe just described there with the pizza, was it Pizza Pop?
Pizza Pop.
I looked it up so pizza quick. Pop. I'm looking at the exclamation cover. I'm looking at
Oh, exclamation marks in there. With like with something like that, you've ascribed value to it because you paid for it. It's not just, you know, a random file that you're selecting off a list. There's not, again, that's not to say that emulation is inherently evil or bad or, you know, all the, like you could go down a huge, we had that discussion on stream, right? You remember, Joe? It was a big discussion on emulation, but, it's not to say that any of that is bad. The accessibility, the availability, the convenience of emulation is amazing. It just doesn't necessarily always, allow people to have, I don't want to say the most ideal experience, but maybe the most valuable experience is a better way to phrase
it. In psychology, they call it the IKEA effect sometimes, which is you put the effort into building the furniture that you bought from IKEA. And by doing so, you ascribe more value to it than if you just had it delivered to you pre-built. Yeah. And I think that's something that we see in gaming as well. I've actually written about that regarding a particular game that I played. About how the IKEA effect is very real. When you put the effort in, you get more value out.
Well, yeah.
Makes total sense. It really does. Well, here's a question from Quest 64 Official, our very friend Quest Guy. There's two questions here. We'll do the second one first. Do you plan to expand the series to Super Famicom, Mega Drive, etc., or is Famicom your single passion?
Good question. Yeah.
Famicom absolutely is not my single passion. I love games. I mean, of every type, US, Japanese, and you know, occasionally even European. That said, like I also know the dangers of planning too big before you've finished one project. So at this moment, Famicom is my sole focus to get this project done. But who knows in the future, right? I have a similar love of Super Famicom, of Sega Saturn, of PlayStation, and the weird, fun, and interesting imports that I can get for those as well. So who knows?
And then his other question, do any of the Japanese Famicom exclusives live up to the hype you personally gave them reading game magazines as a kid? So I feel like that kind of touches on a lot of what we've been discussing, but is there like a specific game that you can remember looking at in a magazine that wasn't exclusive and then you got to play as an adult and it kind of connected that, it bridged that gap?
So that suggests that American magazines said anything at all about Famicom games back in the 80s. And they really didn't. We didn't really start talking about imports until kind of the 32-bit generation. And so the game that really lived up to the hype, and actually the very first game I ever imported from Japan, is Tobal No. 2. Tobal number one is, of course, the fighting game that came with the Final Fantasy VII demo. Absolutely loved the Final Fantasy demo, just as everybody else did. But most people just bought Tobal played it a little bit, and then played the Final Fantasy VII demo. I got super into Tobal. Love Tobal number one. So when I saw that there was a sequel that had a bigger RPG mode and so many more characters to play as and all of that, that was the very first game I ever imported. And I put it in my PlayStation, and that was the day that I learned that American PlayStations couldn't play Japanese games.
I can relate. So, like, that's hilarious. That is really funny. Finding out the hard way.
Yep.
So I'd mentioned on this show before that Hawaii has had, like, a large Japanese population. There's a thriving... you know, imports industry over there makes sense, right? When I was a kid, I remember going into little mom and pop shops and, you know, things like that, and they would have, you know, a Super Nintendo that was just a different color, and I'd be like, hey, that's interesting. It had no idea that it was a Super Famicom, and I remember getting Chrono Trigger because my friend had Chrono Trigger, and I loved it at his house. That's how I first encountered it, fell in love with it. We stayed up all night playing through it, you know. And I was like, I need to get a copy of this game. So I found it. It was just the loose, you know, Super Famicom cart. I was like, it looks a little different. Fine, you know, whatever. Take it home. It doesn't fit in there. And then, you know, a guy at a shop, when I explained that, he's like, oh, all you got to do is cut out these little tabs inside there. So I tell my mom, and she's like, you're not cutting anything out of this plastic box that we spent good money on, you know. So never got to play that, that little cart.
What I like to tell people now is, instead of defacing your Super Nintendo to play Japanese games, if you have a Game Genie, deface the Game Genie. Cut the clips out of that. Use it as a pass-through. Works just fine.
You know what?
I didn't even think of that.
I have a Game Genie.
There you go.
I was just using it the other day to play SimCity. Because cheating is great. And
SimCity's better when you cheat.
Yeah, the first one, yeah, it's super slow. I'm like, this is the fastest speed. Anyway, I'm going to take a picture of my Game Genie, and I'm going to ask you, Joe, what I need to cut out.
All right.
Because those things are cheap, right? Oh, you can still get, like, a Super Nintendo Game Genie. Super cheap. Okay, interesting. Fascinating. Criterion, do you have, like, a moment where you realize, like, oh, I can't just pop this and this and it works with imports?
I'm trying to remember specifically that's tied in. If it was, it might have, I think there was one particular title that I tried to look into to see if it was possible playing. And I think it was for the original PlayStation, because there were a lot of, like, localization was a little bit interesting. I don't know if you were able to play Japanese games specifically, if they were locked in, if there was a region lock for that. I didn't really experience region lock personally for a very long time until I actually started delving into more of the history behind localization. Pretty much what I got was in high school going into college.
Here's a question from Krifton. What is what's Joe's thoughts on Hoshi wo Miru Hito? I've played it. It's something. LOL.
Yeah.
Is that like strip solitaire, or like what are we talking about here?
No, Hoshi wo Miru Hito is it's an RPG. And it is an RPG that does literally everything wrong. If there is a bad idea that you could put into an RPG, they put it there. When you start the game, you start in an overworld. And you just can't see any town or anything. The town is there. It's just invisible. But if you accidentally step on the right square, you enter the town. And then there's like some story thing that they try to claim as to why the town is invisible. But the starting town probably shouldn't be invisible, especially when that's where you get your starting equipment. Most people, when they attempt to play it, assume there's no town there and start walking. But the enemies are too hard without your starting equipment to get anywhere. If you are lucky enough to reach the second town, you enter it. When you leave that town, you end up outside of the invisible first town again for no explained reason. And on through the rest of the game, this nonsense goes. So wow, it is an utterly broken role-playing game. And the thing is, it's become a huge meme to the point where about 5 years ago or so, there was a remake called Stargazers in which they actually made Hoshiwo Miyahito and made it good. And like now there's sort of like this renaissance of people who are just like, oh yeah, Hoshiwo Miyahito was good actually. And it's like, now Stargazers was pretty good though.
Oh man, I can't stand those. It's good actually, TM people.
Right.
I was like, stop it, stop. You're trying to retcon history here.
So the original game, like, I mean, there was a lot of bad RPGs on the Famicom, and I say bad with a more objective sense, right? You can, I mean, yes. You and I agree on this. Objectivity does exist when you are judging the quality of a game in relation to the other games that are out there at the time. Mm-hmm. And Hoshiwo Miyahito, within its original context, was a bad RPG. Someone might still like bad. I like a lot of bad games, but it was bad. But what I find funny is that sort of, and I brought this up a little bit earlier, that idea of almost worshiping Kusoge, ironically.
You're speaking my language right over here, by the way.
Like I
just lit a cigarette. I'm enjoying this. Go ahead.
If you like a game, evangelize it. I do that all the time. Quest Guy does that all the time. You do that all the time, right? You like a game, you evangelize it. If you don't like a game, ignore it. And if you think it's interesting, study it. And that's kind of the way that I look at it is Hoshiwo Miyahito might be interesting to some people. To me, I just ignore it because it's kind of bad.
I mean, and for good reason, based on that description of it, I mean.
Yeah, that does not sound great. And so I was just talking. Oh, yeah. Again, you're speaking my language with this stuff. Like this whole show has been about trying to find the boundary between objective intrinsic qualities and, you know, the kind of the subjective extrinsic interpretations and emotions and reactions that we as observers have towards these artifacts, these pieces of art. And I was just talking with somebody the other day who was infatuated with the like utterly focused on this notion of, but the majority says, you know, it's good or it's bad. Therefore, who are you to say it's good or bad? I was like, but history demonstrates that the majority will change its mind all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, if you want to talk about the majority being wrong, the majority of the West thought that the world was flat at some point. And they were wrong, factually wrong. I'm sorry. It's not a subjective thing. You know, well, I feel like the earth is flat. That doesn't mean anything when you say that. It doesn't. If flat earthers, if you're listening, it doesn't. I'm sorry. That's just, it's fact. But and I get now that when we take it from science to, you know, a game, bear in mind, yeah, it's art. It's commercial art, but also it's math, coding. There's a lot there going on. So I think you have the flexibility to talk about, you know, the design of something, whether that really works for the player on a statistically average sense or not, versus, you know, what kind of one person's interaction with. So, like, of course, this person jumps straight to, you know, the World War II of analogies, right? They're like, well, E.T., you know, like, what if somebody liked E.T.?
Great.
I was like, what if somebody liked E.T.? Like, what does that have to do with it being objectively rushed reproduction?
Yeah. Well, can I just jump in also? I played E.T.
Go
on
ahead.
The Atari because I went to a, retro video game convention years ago and they had...
I'm sorry.
I mean, I liked it. Not the game's terrible. It's hard.
Right,
like,
right.
As you've mentioned, like, I'm not making the argument that it is a good game. Like, of course it is. And
right.
It was a rushed mess of an experience. But the time in which I was able to sit down on a chair, an awkward chair that they had placed there because it was new at the time, the whole convention was new, and just playing E.T. on this like tiny little CRT that came out, I think close to the time in which the game was released, I really enjoyed the experience of doing it, but under that just specific lens and context. And
yeah,
I'm not going to make any argument that the game is good. You can still have a good history with a certain thing
because of an experience, but that doesn't mean that the product itself is good. And I think people have a trouble making that separation sometimes.
Okay. Like,
you can enjoy things that aren't good. That doesn't mean you have to say that they are good because you enjoyed the experience, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm the dinosaur who had a E.T. on the Atari as a kid. And I played it as a kid. And every once in a while, you know, I would pull out Mega Mania or whatever actual exciting fun game that I was playing at the time and pop in E.T. because it was chill. And I could just run around and fall in holes and float around and whatever, right? Yeah. It was not a formative, super memorable gaming experience for me or anything like that. But not every game that I play has to be the most perfect thing. And like, I do think that we need to be careful when we talk objectivity to not go ahead and just lump anything we don't like into the category of objectively bad. And I think there's the Famicom also has a great example of that with Spelunker, a game that has been labeled Kusoge for decades. And it got lumped in on that list all the way back in 1986 when the term Kusoge was initially sort of coined by the Japanese press. And then like mid-2000s, people realized, wait, this game is actually kind of good. Sure, it's weird that you can't fall more than your own body height without dying, and you die when you stumble on every rock, but that actually makes for a really solid set of interesting mechanics that makes a platformer feel different than just another Mario.
Yes.
And it has had a wild second run with multiple HD versions and four-player simultaneous multiplayer, and has become kind of a cult hit. And so like this idea of game is bad, I feel like we do need to sort of recognize, okay, game is bad when it doesn't do anything new and does everything worse than its competitors.
Mm-hmm.
But if
I think that depends on like your there's a great example here too, Joe. I think that depends on your experience as well. You know, like someone like ourselves who's played a lot within a specific context. Mm-hmm. So like you've played a lot of Famicom games, right? Comparatively, I have not. So I think that were I to jump in and play some good Famicom games, some bad Famicom games, my frame of reference would be a lot smaller than yours would be. And so that there's an element of acknowledging that like the experience level of the person making those statements is gonna vary, and you can't exactly hold experience against somebody because everybody has different experiences. But it's to acknowledge that there's a wide range of possible labels and things that you can apply to a game, more than just this is good or this is bad and that's it. Right?
Right.
You use the term interesting. Well, first I like that you said earlier, like it's okay to acknowledge that the game is objectively good and not like it, you know, and not just lump, you know, everything that you don't like into objectively bad. You can kind of tell that person like at a glance, you know, when they like go off on the like some hyperbolic rant about like a game that's probably just too famous for their liking. But for me, The Last of Us is a game where I didn't like it. I didn't find it entertaining. I found it reprehensible, actually, for the most part, but fully acknowledged that it's a pretty well put together game. It has some of the best game performances I've ever seen, and I can acknowledge that. But when you said interesting, I know you know what I know that I thought of, and that's Draken.
Draken is the perfect example.
Freaking Draken. Now, I had a good time playing Draken because I was playing it on stream. Yeah. Fully transparent.
Draken is stream bait. It's the entire game is one big meme. So
yeah, it's not a fun game to play, really. You know, getting smashed by a slime as soon as you're walking towards the first building is not fun. That's terrible game design if, like, the very first monster that you encounter can, like, eat your party alive. Is not fun. It's not fun to have to open your menu you know, to look at a mini map every you know, few seconds. There's so much in that game that is not great, but it can still make for an enjoyable experience and an interesting experience, because like you and I, Joe, we had this whole like tag team thing going on where we're digging into Draken's history to find out if Gary Gygax, creator of D&D, had been involved in the creation of Draken and doing all this detective work. And that was really enjoyable. Streaming was really enjoyable. If I played that game by myself, I would have hated it. Guarantee. So that interest level, it's acknowledging, I think, that interest is subjective, because what's interesting to somebody is not going to be interesting to somebody else.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, I agree.
But finding something that's interesting might take a bit of time and some patience, but you could probably do it, you know, especially if you're streaming.
Maybe. Yeah. And just so you know, as I am going through magazines looking for stuff for my book, I keep finding Draken articles, like previews and stuff. And I keep looking for references to Gary Gygax within the Japanese texts and can't find a thing. So it's
nothing. Yeah. It appears that was really, it was a hyped up game, you know, going to be a launch title for Super Nintendo. I don't know if it was a launch title for Super Famicom.
It was real early. Yeah.
It was early, yeah.
I think so it came out in the U.S. Right near launch, and same in Japan. It came out right near the Famicom launch, or Super Famicom launch.
And it's not a bad launch title, but it is also.
That game's a mess, but it is. It's a wonderful mess. It's an interesting mess.
Yeah. Yeah. We can disagree on the degrees there. I don't want to get to the point. To one of my so I've known Syncoplay for a long time, right? I've known Joe for a long time. I don't know how many years, but we're on Twitter hanging out. One of my favorite tweets from Joe of all time is where he said, "I've only cussed." 3 times on this platform, and 2 of those 3 times were because of the well-read mage. And I don't remember the context or anything like that, but that's my favorite Joe memory right there. All right, let's move on here to context. Question: what is the significance of the difficulty of localization during this period? So to kind of unpack that, something that we were talking about a little while ago is like, why are so many of these games not brought over? The easy answer is money, right? But there's hundreds of thousands of examples, and like different, you know, like some of them were already in English too. Like why was this not brought over, right? Especially if it's based on like a Western IP, for instance. And so maybe you'll have some examples of that. It is, though, a complicated history, localization. Oh. And it's not just, you know, out of Japan to the rest of the world. This is acknowledging there's Chinese games, there's Korean games, there's European games. There are all a variety of games that for a variety of different reasons are locked to their specific region. But for the Famicom specifically, what would you say are some major reasons why we didn't see more of this stuff brought over, and now why you kind of have to do the work for the developers from 30 years ago, the publishers from 30 years ago, to make these things known?
Right. So I think it's a really interesting question. And I think the best way to sort of start is to get an understanding of what the Famicom looked like pre about 1988. The first 5 or so years of the Famicom was very much the Wild West for Nintendo. So they would manufacture cartridges, but they weren't the only ones manufacturing cartridges. Many companies, Irem and Namco and Bandai and a bunch of other companies, all manufactured their own cartridges. Despite the fact that it wasn't like the U.S. where it was, those were unlicensed. Those were licensed games paying the royalties to Nintendo, but manufacturing their own cartridges. Similarly, you know, companies basically didn't need to follow many rules or regulations at all in order to be a publisher. They just had to sign up for the system. So what happened in those first 5 years is that the Famicom got absolutely flooded with developers who were cranking out games as fast as humanly possible, which is where about 1986, the Japanese press starts coining terms like Kusoge, starts talking about how, oh, this is getting flooded with bad games. And so you can really see it around 88, 89 is probably the period in which the difference between good games and bad games were the most prevalent on the Famicom. So when Nintendo brought it over to the US, they saw the mistakes they had made and tried to get ahead of it. And they did so by insisting that they manufacture all their own cartridges, by insisting that publishers could only publish 5 games per year under their label. And the whole goal was, we don't want you bringing all of the bad games here. We want you to only bring the good games. And there's plenty of stuff out there talking about how, like, Konami created the Ultra label just so that they could publish 10 games a year and so on. But that did, in fact, lead to us not receiving certain particularly broken games for the Famicom. But it also led to us sometimes not receiving a lot of really good games that just weren't, that didn't fit within the mold of what Nintendo would give, quote, the seal of quality, which, by the way, was really just a license. I think a kind of a perfect example there is actually Konami's King Kong 2, which is one of my favorite Famicom exclusives. The thing is, it's kind of Rampage meets the Goonies 2, and it's by the same team and the same developers that were doing Goonies 2 and Metal Gear and all of that back in that time. So it has that same sort of semi-open world filled with secrets feeling that is just iconic for Konami at that time. But it's based on the movie King Kong Returns, or King Kong Lives, one of the two. Anyway, and it is completely in English. No reason this shouldn't have come to the West, other than the fact that it was made in 1987, which was the same year that Konami had a massive glut of incredible games all coming out at the same time. That was like their absolute best pinnacle year. On top of that, Nintendo had just got out of a lawsuit with Universal Studios regarding King Kong versus Donkey Kong. So I'm pretty sure Konami looked at King Kong 2 and said, that's not a battle we even want to try to fight, and chose other games from their massively good library for that year, leaving this amazing game just sitting on Japanese shores. And there's a ton of stories like that within in the Famicom once you kind of dig in and find the diamonds in the rough.
That really does underscore the complexity, not just for one game, but now thousands of different games. It's interesting to hear the distinction there between the NES and the Famicom. You know, it's the Famicom sounds more like the Atari 2600, just a flood of games hitting it without kind of a sense of quality control. It seems like
the Famicom was 1983. Right. So it was right at the tail end of the Atari 2600 when Nintendo released it.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, a lot of us talk about the NES as being about quality control, you know, that iconic, you know, official Nintendo seal right on the front of it. And folks try to get around it, Tengen, stuff like that. But I think that was a big part of kind of reinvigorating the industry, obviously, in North America. It's interesting. I hadn't heard that distinction before between those two systems. You kind of just think of like Famicom is just NES, but in Japanese. But it sounds like there's very kind of different colors between these two, very different flavors between these two systems.
And that's one of the things that I try to highlight a lot in my book as well, is the Famicom is its own console with its own personality. And instead of treating it like an NES, I'm treating it like a Famicom. And mm-hmm. that's kind of my goal. And we saw, you know, there was a homogenization that happened in the late 80s where, so the once the Nintendo seal of quality proved in the US that it worked, they sort of brought the same concept back to Japan. And starting in, I think, 1989, there was a logo, the Famicom Family logo, that ended up showing up on all licensed games from Nintendo in Japan. And they started cracking down on too many releases a year and all the same kind of things that they did in the US. So we saw a lot more of a homogenization in the like 89, late 89 through the early 90s. But yeah, early Famicom in particular really had a personality all of its own, which it also makes it the most complicated set of games on the console to sift through, but also potentially the most interesting.
Yeah.
I feel a little justified now when people are like, why is Treasure of Rudress not on your list of Super Nintendo RPGs? I'm like, because it's not Super Famicom RPGs. I feel a little justified. I wonder if you have any thoughts on the difference between localization and translation, Joe. This is something that I think I run into a lot of times. It's not like somebody ever specifically says localization and translation are the same exact thing, but I tend to think people think of them as the same exact thing.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think there's a to me there's one thing that exemplifies the problem with direct translation, and it's the godlike final boss who says, now let me show you my true power. And it's in Japanese, there are set phrases that are often used that sort of exemplify certain personality traits, certain moments in media that just don't exist in Western storytelling. And similarly, Western storytelling has kind of set ideas that don't translate well to Asia. But yeah. When we just directly translate what was said in Japanese, you often end up with really stilted, kind of bizarre language. You end up with just all these funny ways of saying things. And once you kind of are tuned to it, you notice it constantly in especially RPGs, because it's just our languages are fundamentally structured different. The order of the words, the amount of information per sentence is so completely different that when you try to do a direct translation, you end up with awkward language, and we see it all the time. So I am pro localization personally. Mm-hmm. Although you can go too far, and sometimes companies like Working Designs did, inserting American pop culture references and things like that into what should have been a things that are anachronistic to the world that they are trying to create, right? But yeah. In the general
like a,
sense,
a Macarena reference yeah. in Final Fantasy X.
Exactly. Exactly. It's if when it becomes anachronistic, it's a problem. But there's a great example. I don't remember the Japanese version of it, but there is a bit of wordplay in Earthbound, where you go and you knock on somebody's door and they are quizzing you about like this is a Beatles song, blank today. Do you know the answer? And you have the answers yes and no. And it's a play on words, because if you say yes, you get the answer right, yesterday, and if you say no, he's like Notre Day, that's not a word. And it's just as funny. But when you look at the original Japanese text, it was a very similar play on words. You had hi and ie as yes and no, and you had a question in which those would get inserted and create a different word. It was the same idea. But had they attempted to directly translate it, it would have fallen flat. But instead, by yeah. localizing it to something Westerners understood, it worked.
Yeah, same view here. And that's underscored by a couple different things in my mind. The differences between the Hawaiian language and English are significant. Hawaiian language pre-Western contact did not have a written form. So Hawaiian uses, you know, the same alphabet that we do, just far less letters. But as far as like the way that words are structured, you end up with these really long kealakekua kelani, like super long words that will have these really specific meanings. I remember reading in a grammar that I have that like, you know, Hawaiian has like 15 different words for carrying something.
Interesting.
But like it doesn't have a word for like something else like really specific. Oh, like dragon. Like they have a word for like large lizards, mo'o, but they don't, there's no word for dragon in there, which is like kind of bizarre because dragons are so ubiquitous around the world, obviously an isolated culture. Another example, and like this is something that obviously, you know, people with religious views would be more interested in, but even from a purely just interest in language, the Bible is the most translated book in human history. And when you compare some of those translations that are more paraphrase, more woolsey, let's say, than literal, you end up with a variety of different kind of flavored personalities to the translation of the same text, whether that's Greek or Aramaic or Hebrew. And it's acknowledging that, hey, Greek is a different language than English, and Greek is a different language than Hebrew, and Hebrew is a different language than English, and all these different things. So I really am behind – it's weird that we kind of have to say it, like pro-localization. But my opinion is like whenever I meet people who will say, you know, I don't like Woolsey, I personally like Woolsey. I get that he wasn't doing things accurately. Because people will say, I don't like Woolsey because he wasn't accurate. I was like, but the point wasn't accuracy. The point was localization. Part of that is being accurate, obviously. But part of that is making sure that it's regionally understandable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that we don't have idioms that aren't familiar. We don't have figures of speech that rely on cultural touchstones that we simply don't have in our region. Because these were going out to children.
Yeah, I think you that's know, important. Like, it's the age demographic. You're making these incredibly difficult decisions that you know are going to go outside of what the original designers and programmers wanted. But you're having to balance a multitude of different things. But I think something I didn't even think about when it came to the localization process is trying to simplify something for a demographic of a younger audience. I always think of it like if you do a localization, it's because you're trying to like create the essence of what the original idea is as much as possible. But during the time of the late 80s, I feel like in the early 90s, that was not it at all. It was all about marketability and like, how are we going to get American children to like this? I mean, look at Earthbound. I mean, I've talked a lot in the past about Earthbound in terms of particularly its American marketing specifically. But the biggest thing that I come to realize in terms of like how they did the localization process is to like create like a toys writing where it's still accessible to the Western audience, but have this like kind of 90s edge to it that kind of, I think, goes outside of what the game intended for. And I don't know, that's something that's at least a huge part of the localization process that I think about now.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think Sakaguchi-san needs us to white knight for him. Right. Like when we look at the way that a video game is developed, Hironobu Sakaguchi didn't create Final Fantasy in a bubble on his own, hidden away in a vault, right? This isn't Grandma's Boy. Game development is a team project, and lots of people worked on it. Lots of people had their input, and one of those people was Ted Woolsey. He was part of the development team too, and the creative decisions made by the development team include localization. So when we start white knighting for the vision of the original creators, we sometimes forget that the context in which these games are created includes localization.
Perfectly said. Yeah, that's perfectly said right there. It really is, because some people make it sound like Woolsey or whoever else was, you know, not to put Woolsey on a pedestal. Obviously, he's a really famous, iconic translator from the time, localizer from the time. But there were many. But some folk make it sound like they you know, snuck in at night into the publishing studio and stole the game and maliciously translated it into English, censoring out all the things that would offend America. And take that, Japan. That'll show you to put a crucifix in this video game. You know, but it was not some kind of sadistic mangling of language. I think in many ways it was pretty calculated. Mm-hmm. And look at the success of it. That's what I tell folk too. I mean, look at the success of games that were localized at the time. Chrono Trigger. People sometimes complain, why'd they give Frog that these and thous Middle English thing? I didn't care about that when I was a kid. I thought it was cool.
Exactly. It gave him a personality.
Success.
Nobody talked about this until like the 2000s, like late 2000s.
No.
You know what I mean?
Like
no one thought about this at the time because there was no comparison point then. You didn't really understand what the full context of it was. So to go after, especially localization, like during the process of the 90s, it just feels so pointless, at least to me. It's very pointless because it's so encapsulated in which the time in which it took place.
Well, and I think we still, like, I don't know about Frog in particular, but I think sometimes we still, like, don't see the full context of the translation because we don't speak the language. So when we, for example, many characters in Japanese games are written with different dialects of Japanese than sort of like the standard Tokyo dialect. And when you have somebody who is like written to come from rural southern Japan in Japanese, it makes them feel very different from somebody who is written in the dialect of northern Japan, Tokyo, or whatever, right? And so that those dialects are sometimes a creative choice when they bring them to the West. It's like, oh, well, the closest match we have to that dialect is these and thous, or the closest thing we have to that dialect is a good old Southern boy. Right. Mm-hmm. And we sometimes don't even talk about that when we're talking about translation because we don't understand the subtleties of Japanese dialect. We're not native.
Right. Watching Naruto doesn't make you a Japanese expert. It just doesn't. I'm sorry. But yeah, I mean, there's a wealth of different examples of different dialects just in English. You know, the Londonese, oh, whoa, you know, wolf we day today. And then, you know, the hello, governor, like this, both English, but vastly different in sounds. Question here from 700MX700M. All right, I've got one for you. How do you think the decision of which games to localize and bring to the U.S. affected the U.S.'s interpretation of Nintendo? And do you think it played a major part in Nintendo becoming the family gaming company in future generations of games? So again, calculated. Was it so calculated to create this kind of family-friendly then perspective of Nintendo?
Absolutely. And I would say two decisions in particular were cemented Nintendo as the family game console targeting kids and particularly targeting young boys. One of those decisions was where they sold the games. So Atari games were often sold in the electronics aisle. They were targeting kind of the adults that had expendable income and would buy them to play with their kids. They'd put them in electronics aisles and they were high-end stuff. And Nintendo associated itself more with toys. And when they did that, and the American toy market was very split at the time between boy toys and girl toys. You were Barbie or you were G.I. Joe. And Nintendo had to basically, when they decided to sell in the toy aisles, they had to pick one and they picked boys. And that vastly changed the types of games that they were like that anybody was willing to bring to the West, because now the games needed to appeal specifically to younger boys. And that sort of had a trickle down effect even in Japan for later games, because now if you wanted to make a game that you planned to release in the West, you had to consider Western tastes in that. The second big decision that I think Nintendo made that totally changed and affected our interpretation of them was to put Howard Phillips, their PR, their lawyer, as their front and center PR guy, a somewhat goofy looking dude in a red bow tie who was very charismatic and approachable and absolutely fierce in the law room, right? Or in the courtroom. And by putting, making the guy who was basically setting Nintendo up to stomp the competition in every way, shape, and form legally, and making him the good guy in the press and having him doing interviews with the media and with magazines, and even as far as Nintendo Power, having the Howard and Nestor comic strip in which Howard has his fictional sidekick Nestor and they go on video game adventures. He became an idol to kids, which made us much less likely to judge some of the really harsh stuff that Nintendo was doing regarding lawsuits and trying to put the competition out of business at the same time.
Yeah. He was up at the, was he up at the hearings?
Absolutely.
The Congress hearings or no?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I thought I was remembering correctly. He was pretty vicious there, as
I recall. He was vicious for a long time, right? There's quite a few stories. There's a great book. I don't remember who wrote it. It's called Game Over, that sort of goes through the history of kind of the first 10 or 15 years of Nintendo as a game developer. And it's fascinating to see how much effort Nintendo put into elevating Howard Phillips in the public eye, and then letting him do his thing in the courtroom to protect Nintendo and Nintendo's assets. It's fascinating. It's a good read.
Yeah, it's funny. It's that it's that very cheery kind of like family friendly exterior, mm-hmm. but it's totally still Nintendo, right? Yeah. The very cheery, happy Nintendo Direct. You know, hey, thanks so much for watching our show about Squid and Kirby and Mario and all.
And now
that,
don't you dare stream anything about it.
Right. Oh God. Backside is just how protective they are of that stuff. Well, okay, let's move on here. Here's a question. If you could choose one Japan exclusive video game to be released in the West, what game would you choose? And this came from Joe himself. He helped me come up with this question. Let's start with you, Jared.
Oh, come on. That's you, because you're probably going to know what my answer is. You already probably know what my answer is.
Oh, I do. I.
Well, maybe you
do. It's Mother 3 in it.
I feel like it shouldn't be at this point. I have such a complicated history. Again, Earthbound is my favorite game of all time. Mother 3, I played the fan translation, through channels, unfortunately, because there's no Western release of it. Became one of my incredible, just. I want. It will always be my number one choice for a game that I would love to have officially localized and have accessible to an American audience, the same way that Earthbound and even Mother and Earthbound Beginnings has. But by the same token, as I'm starting to get older, I'm starting to think to myself, even though it is my number one choice, is it fully necessary? And this is the big thing that comes with a lot of things in terms of, I think, the passing of time with localization. It almost feels like my number one choice has so much personal bias behind it because I have already experienced the game in full, which is not the same as saying I would prefer this game, which I've never played before, that I think if I had a localization of it, I would play it. So that makes the question very tricky for me. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like, is it right for me to say that I want Mother 3, even though I have played Mother 3 in full in my native language because of obviously the efforts of Clyde and his localization effort. So I'm going to say Mother 3, but I'm going to put an asterisk next to it because I have a very, I'm not saying I'm questioning myself, but there's a little bit of probing that I'm even doing within my own logic of where I'm coming up with that answer.
Well, because let me ask you, do you think that Mother 3 would be acceptable in the West today?
There are absolutely elements of the game, which I mean, I won't talk about specifically because obviously I don't know.
Right, right.
Like within the realm, there are elements of the story and themes that I don't know where Nintendo stands on some of it. And the thing is, like, Nintendo does publish more mature themed games now over the last 10, 15 years. I think everyone can probably agree to that. But what makes Mother 3 difficult is because of how Earthbound is presented to the West, specifically in the context of like Smash Brothers. It's just weird. It's a very Mother 3 is a very, very mature game. And it's much more direct in its mature themes than Earthbound is. My argument is that Mother, Earthbound Beginnings, whatever you want to call it, and Earthbound have incredibly mature themes that like toe the line. But it's a little bit more subtle within a toy's writing. Mother 3 is not like that. Mother 3, a toy's writing is as direct as possible about what makes this game, I don't want to say not family friendly, but possibly to a point where it's like, if they were going to do an official localization, how would they handle this subject matter? So yeah, that's at least how I see
that's
it.
My biggest concern, and that was probably Nintendo's absolutely concern at one point too.
I feel like it's funny because I actually think that we are, as gamers, I think there would be no issue if it was rated properly and marketed properly to have most of the mature themes in Mother 3 come out in the West. There is one group in particular in that game that just would not fly at all in Western culture. It barely flies anymore in Eastern culture. And I think that before Mother 3 could ever be released, they would have to choose to localize and change art assets, text, everything about a particular group in that game. Yes. And by doing so, I think that the fan community would go crazy that they went and modified the art that was Mother 3. And I think, personally, I think that's really what Nintendo will stop Nintendo from ever releasing it here, is that they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, or as Nomura would put it, the whispers are watching.
I hate that. I hate that you said that right now. I hate that. You know what? You're absolutely right though, because then you're either stuck with, you're putting out a controversial game that, I mean, we could see every game today is controversial.
Yeah.
You know, Starfield comes out and it's huge explosion of, you know, people arguing back and forth over like one thing. There's no way that Mother 3 could come out intact and not be controversial in the West. At the same time, like you use the term modification, it would essentially be censorship.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. I mean,
you would be changing something fundamentally in order for it to be more acceptable. That's essentially censorship. And that would be controversial in its own sense. So you're absolutely right. Stuck between a rock and a hard place. There's no real good answer.
And I think the thing is that people don't realize that the flexibility that the Mother series has in Japan to tackle these themes is because Shigeo Sato Itoi is a celebrity in Japan. He was able to get away with anything that he essentially wanted to put in his writing or within the style of the Mother series because of how much of a household name Itoi is in Japan. That's not the case in America. You know what I mean? So it's harder to, I don't know. This is the thing. I always say that the most important thing about the Mother series is Shigeo Sato Itoi. Like his celebrity status within Japan, his history and copyright in relation to how it impacts his entire series. Which, you know, if you're someone like me that's obsessed with the series, and I know a lot of us are, like you understand that sort of context. But to the general audience that doesn't really know that much about Itoi and the decisions that he makes in terms of what he does with the series, it's like, I don't know. I think that's the thing they struggle with Mother 3 a lot, is the fact that at that point, Shigeo Sato Itoi pretty much was able to make whatever game he wanted because he already had two established games that he did with Nintendo prior. But that's in the specific realm of Japan, in my opinion. I mean, I don't know if that really translated it into the Western audience. Because you're right, then it's a localization in which you have to incorporate different things, you have to change things. And then how much of it is still intact at that point? So, but that's, again, I'm getting to, so you're mentioning Mother and Earthbound, and I'm going to go down the rabbit hole. So I'll just say Mother 3 and go from there.
It's a big topic. What about you, Joe? One game Japan exclusive to be released in the West.
So I kind of went through the same mindset as Jared did when I was thinking through this, which is there's a lot of games that I can already play in English.
Yeah.
And do I really care whether or not they got released in the West? And so one of my favorite kind of classic game series is the Goemon series. and released, you know, a few of them got released here. We got Legend of the Mystical Ninja for the Super Nintendo, which is a formative game for me growing up. We got a couple of Nintendo 64 entries. But in Japan, there was like 15, 16 entries in the Goemon series. It's massive. And kind of after the Nintendo 64, kind of during the PlayStation 2 era, and even during on Game Boy Advance, there were some, let's just call them experiments, that they did with the Goemon series, taking them into the future and doing all this kind of weird stuff. And they tried this sort of almost Harvest Moon feeling thing on PlayStation 2. And the series just got, it lost its soul. It lost what made Goemon great. And on the Nintendo DS, the very last Goemon game went back to its roots, brought back the wacky hijinks of feudal Japan, brought back the original feel, but in this cool watercolory style. The game was fun. It was the same lighthearted stuff that I'd grown up with. And it stayed in Japan. And by staying in Japan, a game often very strongly limits its potential sales. So for me, if any game from Japan could have been released in the West, I'd have done the Nintendo DS version of Goemon in the hopes that that could have made it profitable enough that that series would have continued past it.
That's a really generous answer right there. That's good. I like that series too, but yeah, it's a shame. It is a shame what happens. So for me, I actually already did get my dream a game brought over. It was Radical Dreamers. And I was pretty ecstatic when they announced that was going to be part of the re-release of Chrono Cross. Finally get to play it, you know, and those things already had fan translations, and there's nothing wrong with fanslations. I think it's awesome that fans are taking, the time and effort to translate these things themselves when there's no real kind of momentum for an official translation. It's just not typically an area of gaming that I explore, mods or translations or emulation, that sort of thing. I always really do prefer an official translation, so it has that extra kind of that stamp on it, you know. Mm-hmm. So getting a play through Radical Dreamers was great. Was it worth the wait? No. it's not a fantastic game, I don't think, but it's an interesting one. There you go. But besides for that, I would probably say Dragon Quest X, another pretty popular answer for this that we got a couple times in the thread, I think. But reason for that is I did manage to install with a couple friends Dragon Quest X. We were going to play it together. That, of course, is the Japan only MMO. And there is a... it's a lot of game. I mean, it's an MMO, right? Yeah. So you're looking at an app that'll kind of like live translate for you as you're playing this. Like you put a little window over where the dialogue box is and it'll translate. The problem with that is it's everything you would expect from machine translation,
of
right?
Course.
Like, you know, they'll go from 1 second to be like, okay, you need to go to the castle to get this magic staff so that you can beat the wizard, to I have chicken on my head. Would you like pudding today? And they're like, that, what are you talking about? You know? So, it's a work in progress. Like the full thing, well, at least when I tried it, the full thing was not translated anyway. It's a novelty, to me at that point. I would rather play the full game in English, of course, than, you know, whatever kind of robot English this is. But you take what you can get at the same time. There's an excellent, thriving community that is doing incredible work to make that game available, you know, worldwide when there doesn't seem to be any specific momentum to get that worldwide. We do have a couple great answers from people. There are a lot of great answers on that thread. Obviously, I can't mention everybody, but I did want to cite a couple of these. Rainbow Cat GX said, me on my way to suggest Mother 3 like a foaming mad dog. Probably, again, the most popular answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we just mentioned this, but Sparrow talks about it again. Dragon Quest X Online. Not because I want to play it. I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. But I know a lot of people want it, LOL. See, I didn't realize that it was infamous in that regard. Like Dragon Quest X.
Yeah, I think Sparrow just doesn't like MMOs, yeah, maybe.
Possibly.
You know? It's, by all accounts, it's great, but just can't really play it in English.
Yeah, I would love to see us get a localization of the offline version of it, which they released, I think, last year in Japan.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
So Krifton said, Konami YY World, because you have a game with Mikey from the Goonies and Simon Belmont join forces. It also has Goemon. It has King Kong. Yeah, YY World is kind of a kick in the pants. It's a Famicom game, so it'll definitely show up in my book.
Nice. Looking forward to that. Sounds like the Konami's Smash Brothers from that roster of characters. This is from Anurin Plays. Probably Captain Rainbow. Just seems like such a bonkers game. That's one that I've seen pictures of, but I don't know what's bonkers about it. I mean, it's called Captain Rainbow. Like, you can probably expect a lot of zaniness in that game.
That was from an era where Nintendo, I mean, this is the era that WarioWare came from. So you understand kind of the level of weird that Captain Rainbow shares with WarioWare, shares with the Tingle games, right? That was when Nintendo was on something.
Tingle, yeah, say no more.
There you go.
So this is Kumakan 22 that says Kamen no Ninja Hanamaru, which was completely reskinned and brought to the US as one of my favorite titles. Yo, Noid. The original looks great and has a completely different look and feel when you are playing as Hanamaru and his hawk companion. A very interesting answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this is also a little known fact, but Joe here is actually the Noid guy who went and you held up a pizza parlor, didn't you? Right? You spent some time for that.
Shh, not supposed to know about that.
You're like when you were you hiding. Were like, I'm a big fan of Yo Noid. I was like, I bet you are.
Strange Vision 99 says, I'm interested in Square's early games on platforms like the PC-88 and Famicom, so I'll pick up the Death Trap. It's Sakaguchi's first released game, but I'd also like the sequel. Will the Death Trap 2, featuring technical innovations and Uematsu's first video game composition?
Wow. Okay. Very cool. Yeah.
I know nothing haven't about that. Now I have something to research.
Yeah. Now, see, this for me, this is the same thing as like 3D Battles of Worldrunner, where I'm like, wait a minute. These two guys I know are on here, but I'd not heard of Will the Death Trap 2. I think I'd heard of Death Trap. But Sakaguchi had done a couple of robot games, some mech games before Final Fantasy. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
I think so.
Nobody knows?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up. Anyway. I could pretend.
I might have just pulled that out of thin air then. I don't know. Who knows? We can neither deny nor verify. let's see. And then we have ABXYLR the Gamer who said, okay. The OU sound in the middle, Bishoujo?
Bishoujo.
Bishoujo. Yeah. Okay, got it. Bishoujo Senshi Sailor Moon, another story. And then he says, it's Chrono Trigger with a Sailor Moon chasis, which...
Oh, no.
That's quite a statement right there.
Them fighting words.
Now, I have played this game. I've messed around with it. I've not beaten it by any stretch. But that's a cool reference, though, right there. There's... at least two Sailor Moon games on Super Famicom that I know of. I don't know if there's more, but I remember Sailor Moon being pretty popular over here. It was like, you know, like a bunch of boys going home from school. They're like, let's watch Sailor Moon. And then, you know, ogling the screen. So they could have released maybe some of these over here, but they didn't.
I mean, I've got a Super Famicom Sailor Moon. I want to call it like an Adventures of Lolo like.
Interesting. That's like that old like cube pushing puzzle game, right? Yep. On NES. Yeah, I hadn't heard about that one for a while.
Oh, hold on, wait. I think I've got one more. Right, we have one more here.
Yes,
this is one from Sommerfelt R. Police Knots, some of the best pixel art of the era and a very underrated gem. And I've never heard of this game, and I'm actually going to look it up like real quick.
This is Kojima.
It's kind of his prequel to Snatcher.
Which I remember buying the TG-16 Mini and being like, Snatcher, and then you find out it's in Japanese.
I have seen this. See, of course, I see the cover immediately. I'm like, all right. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. There's a poster for it in Metal Gear Solid, I think. Or is that Zone of the Enders? Might have been Zone of the Enders.
Don't know.
There's a Metal Gear Solid fan listening who's like screaming right now.
There's always someone screaming at this point.
There's always someone screaming. All right, so folks, here's what's going to happen. Initially, this was slated to be a Doki Doki Panic episode, right? But I think the discussion about things like localization, the flavor of the Famicom, a lot of Nintendo history and things like that are so important and so vital and interesting, there to use that key word of the episode again, that what we're going to do is we're going to make this just the Famicom episode. So don't be alarmed. You know, if you're starting, you're like, I thought that we were going to talk about Doki Doki Panic. Don't have a Doki Doki Panic. Just realize that that's coming. We're going to do that for our next episode, episode 96. But this will be styled as the Famicom episode, which I don't think we've done an episode on a single system before. So, Joe, you have the historical privilege of being on the first MageCast X episode that's on a single system, and the first MageCast X episode on anything related to the Famicom ever.
Nice. My plan is working.
Everything is proceeding as I have foreseen. We do have a couple final things here. This is from Not a Fan of Cops, who said, any particularly good Famicom RPGs that we missed out on the US? Missed out on in the US. I am sure there are hundreds, but can you give us like four?
Oh, boy. We could do an entire episode just on that topic. Yeah. But, there's a ton. And what's amazing about the Famicom RPGs is they were still early enough that the amount of text was not as heavy as some later games, which means that a huge majority of them have had fan translation patches and can be played in the West, which is great. As far as just like turn-based RPGs and stuff goes, to me, you can't go wrong with pretty much anything Konami put their name on. Lagrange Point, Esper Dream 2, excellent games that used Konami's special chips, the same things they used in their action games, in order to have better graphics, better music, bigger games than what anybody else was making. We didn't see any of their stuff over here. Similarly, they did two Goemon-themed RPGs. Let me go back to my love of Goemon. The Goemon Gaiden series was a RPG series for the Famicom that's well worth checking out. You know, lots of people love to point at Sweet Home as the pre-Resident Evil, but it was also a great RPG from Capcom. Sorry, Red, I am going past four, because I do have to mention on the action RPG side, we've got stuff like Grandmaster, which was it was a non-linear action RPG with multiple endings that was just... It was so far ahead of its time. The story would change depending on what order you would do the levels in. And it was fantastic. And then even on early on, back in the mid 80s, Namco brought us Valkyrie Nohoken, which was a early, just barely after Dragon Quest action RPG that while it has the same kind of rough edges you would expect early on, it is... I would say it has the same kind of well-paced grind curve that the original Dragon Quest had. Mm-hmm. So if you like that sort of thing of just being able to sit back, chill, grind up, explore dungeons, Valkyrie Nohoken is a fantastic place to find that. So
there's my
short list.
There's your short list. The long list is by his books.
True.
And you did it without naming any Final Fantasy, which I think is really excellent. We're living in a very Final Fantasy-centric society, let's say.
We all know Final Fantasy. But, we all know Dragon Quest.
Yeah, yeah. There's more to life than Final Fantasy. Believe it or not. Go outside.
Touch grass.
Yeah. No, I wasn't good at that far. You can go outside, bend over if you want. You don't have to touch grass. Anyways, Joe, hey, it's exciting that I can say, you know, more than we'd love to have you back on. We would love to have you back on. And it's exciting that that we'll have the opportunity to have a discussion again. And again, next time that will be specifically more on the Doki Doki, the Mario type stuff. But I'm glad we had kind of an overview here, especially since this is a system that a lot of people aren't very familiar with as far as our audience goes. Hosts included. That's me. I don't have a ton of experience with Famicom. So it was great to hear from you. It was great to kind of absorb some of your museum-like knowledge here of this system. But would you please give us a little more taste of your book and, you know, when that might be coming? Just what can we look forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you again for having me. I'm happy to come back on the show. This has been a blast. So real good stuff.
Awesome.
As far as the book goes, so it is Beyond the NES. You can get a sample book right now at beyondthenes.com. Despite what Moses tells you, I am not asking for your social security number, only your email. So the book is basically a deep dive into appreciating the Famicom as an English speaking gamer. So I go through, I track down all of the games that you can play without knowing the Japanese language, help you through the rough spots, if you do, need language in certain parts of the game. As well as just an overall celebration of the interesting landscape that is the Famicom library. We've got an interview in there with the Russian video game comrade, who is, he grew up in a country that played Famicom, but did so in bootlegs on a Dendy console, which is a fascinating read to see his point of view on things. We've got game reviews, walkthroughs, top 30 lists scanned and analyzed straight out of original Famicom magazines from Japan. And just kind of run the gamut in there of different ways of exploring the Famicom, all done in the style of a classic gaming magazine from the late 80s, early 90s. So, come check it out. As far as timing for the rest of it goes, the current sample book is it's a 32-pager. The final book, I'm targeting around 250 pages, and the most I can say the timing right now is I'm targeting the first half of next year.
Okay.
Now, it is very much a labor of love project for me, so it's going to be done when it's done, but it's not going to be one of those things that I go on for years and years and years just saying, oh yeah, it's going to be done sometime, right? I am excited to get this thing finished and out into everybody's hands. So targeting the first half of next year for that.
Okay.
Perfect. Nice. And I think you're approaching this the right way too. You're not like taking people's money now on Kickstarter and then 10 years later, oh, by the way, here's your exclusives, you know?
Right.
So it's not a predatory approach to anything like crowdfunding or you know, a pet project or anything like that. People, I know some people personally who can be a little apprehensive about that sort of thing, but the dude put out a free sample. So go check it out. Again, there's a link in the description. Jared, you want to add anything before I,
I just wanted to thank Joe for the time. Cause again, my very first console was the NES, and I've always been looking for a way to dabble more into the Famicom era. And I think even just with the sample size that I've been looking at, not only is it a labor of love, it is just a labor of information that I think for anyone that is interested in anything retro related with gaming, it's just, there's so much in there. And I love episodes like this. I love going into these things, not knowing. And then now I have a whole list of titles that I need to look up, especially the one that you said was like a pirate one, like the Zelda pirate one. I don't know. A lot of amazing topics that we covered today. And yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to thank Joe for the time again. And I'm going to be checking out this book when it comes out. I can promise you that right now.
Well, thank you.
Definitely, definitely. So, folks, again, tune in next time when we do actually talk about Doki Doki.
We promise we'll do it this
Panic
time.
And Mario 2. We will. We will. Watch us like wind up just talking for 2 hours about like a mustache. Oh,
probably. Knowing us, probably. Like, nothing
else. All right, all right.
Just be Draken memes the whole time.
Ah, Draken memes. You got to sneak it in one more time. Hack, hack, Draken, everybody. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next time. Red Leader signing off. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to MageCast X. If you enjoyed the conversation, here's what you can do next. Browse through our library and check out another episode. You could also leave a review or rating on your app of choice, such as Apple or Spotify. You could go the extra mile and support us on patreon.com/thepixels. Finally, you could join our Discord community and find us at our social accounts in the podcast description. This episode may be over, but the legend will live on. Passed down by the dwarves, the elves, and the dragons.